Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Sam, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's workshop. This is a teleconference, and it's sponsored. It's collaboration with the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, and the title of our program today is Emerging Therapies in Hodgkin and T-Cell Lymphomas. And today's a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and Lymphoma Research Foundation and a number of other organizations as well. And it's really because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 633 participants on the call today from all over the United States. And we do have international participants from Australia, Bangladesh, Belgium, Canada, France, India, Nepal, Spain, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. This program is supported through unrestricted educational grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Celgene Corporation, Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company, Seattle Genetics, and Spectrum Pharmaceuticals. And I really want to thank them for their support of the program and for their collaboration in supporting this program as well. Now, we have just wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Stephen Ansell. And Dr. Ansell is professor of medicine at Mayo Clinic, and he is going to address an overview of Hodgkin lymphoma, emerging treatments for Hodgkin lymphoma, and the role of clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Ansell.
Thank you very much. Thanks also to everybody for being on the call. Just as I start off, I first want to say just a few words about lymphoma in general, just to paint the picture. Then, as mentioned before, I'll talk about an overview of Hodgkin lymphoma, then emerging treatments, and subsequently the role of clinical trials. So basically, I think it's important to know that lymphoma is a cancer of lymphocytes. Cells within the body that normally would fight infection are now have undergone genetic mistakes and changes, and this has caused the cells to be much more aggressive in their growth pattern and much more resistant to dying off. I think it's important also to know that there are a variety of different lymphomas, and we will be talking about some of them today, but not all of them. And broadly, these fall into two large categories. B lymphocytes are cells that usually make antibodies, and therefore the majority of lymphomas are B-type lymphomas or B-cell lymphomas. Secondly, there are other types of lymphocytes called T lymphocytes, which very often fight infection as far as fighting viruses are concerned. And as Dr. Owen O'Connor later will address, we'll talk about T-cell lymphomas as well. Important to know that within the B-cell lymphoma category, there are non-Hodgkin lymphoma and Hodgkin lymphomas. And we're going to be talking in a minute about Hodgkin lymphoma. And this is a disease characterized by what is called the Reed-Sternberg cell, which is a cancer cell that recruits a lot of other cells around it to help with its growth pattern. So with that, I'd like to then talk a little bit about Hodgkin lymphoma specifically, and as I mentioned earlier, then take it into emerging treatments and the role of clinical trials. So firstly, I think as far as Hodgkin lymphoma is concerned, it's important to know that this is a relatively uncommon disease. It affects about 9,000 new patients in the United States every year. And it's a disease that often is seen in young adults, often in patients in their 20s. But there's also a further group of patients that are 55 years and older who can also get the disease. The risk factors for this disease include familial factors, viral exposures, and immune suppression. To talk about that a little bit further, when studies have been done on family members of patients who have Hodgkin lymphoma, same-sex siblings of patients with Hodgkin lymphoma have a tenfold increased risk of developing Hodgkin lymphoma, and the cause for that is really not well understood. Equally poorly understood is the role of viruses in this disease, and the reason that may be important is that often Epstein-Barr virus is found to be associated with patients with Hodgkin lymphoma, and often the virus is actually incorporated into the genetic material. But many people in the world are exposed to this virus and don't get Hodgkin lymphoma, so therefore it's not entirely clear as to what this virus may be doing. Other viruses, more common viruses, actually can be protective against Hodgkin lymphoma, so the whole role of viral exposures is still unclear. What is much more clear, though, is that people who develop immune suppression are at significant risk. So those that have infections with the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV virus, have a significant increased risk of developing Hodgkin lymphoma. Important to know that typical symptoms of this disease are patients often present with enlarging lymph nodes, often above the diaphragm, so often in the neck, sometimes in the chest, often above the clavicles or in the axillae or the armpits. Less commonly, but also seen, are groin lymph nodes and intra-abdominal lymph nodes. And about a third of patients, when diagnosed, present with systemic symptoms, meaning they get high fevers, they get drenching sweats, they lose a lot of weight unintentionally, and although not really a constitutional symptom, a lot of patients present with significant itching that isn't well explained by other reasons. To make the diagnosis of Hodgkin lymphoma, you have to get a biopsy, and it's important that an excisional biopsy be done. In other words, a whole lymph node be taken out, because as I mentioned earlier, the Reed-Sternberg cell is a cell that we want to identify under the microscope, and there can be a lot of inflammatory cells, and so if one only takes a very small sample, this can be a difficult diagnosis to make. It's an interesting disease because the tumor cells are actually in the minority, and much of what is seen in the biopsy are inflammatory reactive cells. There are two large categories within Hodgkin lymphoma. Most people get what is called classical Hodgkin lymphoma, but there is a less common, in fact, quite rare variant called nodular lymphocyte predominant Hodgkin lymphoma. Once a diagnosis has been made, when one is seen by your physician, the first order of business and very important for your future management is staging of the disease, and this is critical because it is used in the decision-making for treatment, and a PET scan is often done along with a bone marrow in some patients to determine where in the body the disease currently is active. That will help to define, as I'll mention in a minute, exactly what therapy needs to be given. Some things that will tell your doctor as to whether your disease is likely to cause more trouble or less trouble down the line has to do with the amount of disease, or what we call disease bulk. So people that have very large mediastinal masses or masses in their chest or multiple different sites of disease or a lot of abnormal blood tests, these can be predictive of a disease that's more likely to be aggressive. Switching gears then and talking a little bit about standard therapy. The initial therapy, as I mentioned before, is driven in large part by where in your body the disease is present. And patients are categorized into early stage, in other words, just one side of the diaphragm, or more advanced stage, meaning more diffusely throughout the body. And early stage patients, based on those prognostic factors or the factors that tell one about how the disease is likely to behave, are further categorized into what we call favorable disease or unfavorable disease. So for patients that have early stage disease, the most common approach is to do what is called a combined modality therapy. In other words, patients receive a short course of chemotherapy and then received what involved field radiation therapy just to the sites of enlarged lymph nodes. Patients who have more advanced disease will commonly receive only chemotherapy and no radiation treatment. The favorable or unfavorable categorization of limited stage disease allows us to limit how much chemotherapy one needs and how much radiation one needs. So those that are in a very favorable category may only receive two or three cycles of chemotherapy followed by radiation versus those in unfavorable categories who will receive more cycles, typically four cycles of treatment. Patients who have advanced disease typically receive ABVD chemotherapy for at least 6 cycles of treatment, but for those that have a number of poor prognostic features, they may require more aggressive treatment, and other therapies such as a BICOP combination is considered. And lastly, if the disease actually does recur after initial treatment, the common approach thereafter is to treat people with high doses of chemotherapy and an autologous stem cell transplant. Autologous stem cell transplant meaning using your own stem cells to rescue after the high dose of chemotherapy. So that in just a few sentences is an overview of Hodgkin lymphoma. I wanted to mention as a second point then emerging treatments in Hodgkin lymphoma. And I think it's important to know that a number of new drugs are being tested in Hodgkin lymphoma and have been shown to have significant activity. Hodgkin lymphoma commonly is positive for a protein on the cell surface called CD30, and a new antibody drug conjugate called brentuximab vedotin binds to CD30 and delivers chemotherapy into the cell. That's resulted in a very high response rate in patients that have had their disease come back even after undergoing an autologous stem cell transplant. Other treatments include therapies such as panobinostat or lenalidomide or everolimus. These therapies target or interfere with messaging pathways or with the support structure around the cancer cell. And again, in the patients that have had autologous transplants, have shown significant benefit. So these are therapies that are now being moved earlier into the disease course and being added to some of the standard treatments I mentioned just a little bit ago. And finally, just wanted to talk about the role of clinical trials. So I think what is very important as we understand the disease is to then understand what is the best therapy. And the standard treatments that are currently used are standard in that they have been tested in clinical trials. And as we move forward, having patients and physicians participate in clinical trials allow us to really confirm that some of these new drugs can be safely administered on their own or can be safely combined with other therapies and then can be compared to these standard therapies to hopefully show superiority as far as the number of patients who benefit and the durability of that benefit. My recommendations always to patients is to consider participating in a clinical trial because not only would you potentially receive what is felt to be the newest and best therapy, you'll also receive very close scrutiny of your progress in the hopes of providing you with the very best outcome. So with that, I'll stop and pass it back to the chairperson.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ansel, for just a really superb presentation and really for addressing really some of the state of the art in the treatment of Hodgkin's lymphoma and making this all very understandable, the complex understandable for our participants here. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Owen O'Connor. Dr. O'Connor is professor of medicine and experimental therapeutics. He's also director, Center for Lymphoid Malignancies, Department of Medicine. He's co-director, Program of Lymphoid Development and Malignancies, the Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center, Columbia University Medical Center, the New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. O'Connor is going to address an overview of T-cell lymphoma, emerging treatments for systemic T-cell lymphoma, and the role of clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. O'Connor.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you, Brian, for putting together this very important program, and thank you to all the registrants and participants for partaking. As Steve told you a little bit about the origins of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in general, explaining that these are, in fact, malignancies of a kind of white blood cell we refer to as the lymphocyte, he also explained that many lymphomas come in at least two broad flavors, those derived from the B lymphocytes and those derived from the T lymphocytes, giving rise to T-cell lymphoma. Each year in the United States, there are about 70,000 cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and interestingly, there are about 70 different types of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So if you were to spread it out like butter on bread evenly, that would mean there's only about 1,000 cases of each of those subtypes. But What's really interesting is that we know that the two most common subtypes of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which accounts for about 25% to 30% of all non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and follicular lymphoma account for half of that 70,000 cases per year. So that means that the remaining 67, 68 different subtypes of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma are actually comprised by those residual 35,000 cases. The T-cell lymphomas, like Hodgkin's disease, are actually very rare diseases. Each year in the United States, they're felt to be somewhere between 6 and 10,000 cases per year. And like many of the B-cell lymphomas, there's a diversity of T-cell lymphomas, and there's probably somewhere between 50 and 20 different subtypes of T-cell lymphoma. When we think about many kinds of lymphoma, usually the first cut lymphoma docs will think about is, are these aggressive diseases or indolent diseases? And many subtypes of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma can be broken down that line as being more aggressive or being more indolent and chronic. Obviously, the therapies for the type of disease you have are tailored based upon the risk and the aggressiveness. With many aggressive subtypes of lymphoma, like diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, the most common, usually requiring systemic chemotherapy to be managed and even cured in the majority of patients, while for more indolent diseases like follicular lymphoma, oftentimes the treatments are tailored to the risk of the disease, and many times those therapies are quite indolent. Across the spectrum of the T-cell lymphomas, for the most part, these are typically thought of as aggressive diseases, though as we'll hear in a moment from Dr. Kim, some of those forms of the disease that manifest in the skin are actually can be somewhat indolent, though some may go on to have more aggressive courses. When we think of T-cell lymphomas and we try to put in context the diversity of these diseases, we typically break them down into lymphomas that comprise, that belong to one of four different categories. Those that may be described as cutaneous T-cell lymphomas, like mycosis fungoides, that we'll hear about in a minute. Some of them are actually predominantly leukemic diseases, like HTLV-1 adult T-cell leukemia lymphoma. And that disease predominantly presents in the blood with cytopenias. Many forms of T-cell lymphoma actually present in lymph nodes, like you just heard about Hodgkin's disease and like many of the other forms of B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And in fact, the most common of these is a disease often referred to as PTCL-NOS, or peripheral T-cell lymphoma not otherwise specified, and the anaplastic large cell lymphomas, which typically have a very, very favorable outcome, while PTCL not otherwise specified, generally doesn't do as well as patients with anaplastic large cell lymphoma. And we know that many subtypes of PTCL can actually present in extranodal locations, including in the gut, oftentimes referred to as enteropathy-associated T-cell lymphoma, and sometimes in the nasal sinuses referred to as a nasal NK T-cell lymphomas. So many of these diseases over the years, the paradigms that we've used to treat them have largely come from our experiences in B-cell lymphoma. And one of the things we've learned over the last several years is that many of those paradigms used to treat B-cell lymphoma successfully haven't actually worked as well treating T-cell lymphomas. But the good news is that over the last several years, in fact, over about the last 3 years, the U.S. FDA has approved now at least three new drugs for the treatment of these diseases. And what's interesting about some of these drugs is that they seem to work almost exclusively in T-cell lymphomas and actually have very little effect in B-cell lymphomas, which in my mind is testament to the fact that there may be a unique treatment platform for the T-cell lymphomas that looks nothing like the treatment platforms or resembles very little the treatment platforms that we use for B-cell lymphoma. So some of those new drugs include pralatrexate, which is a drug that we helped develop, was actually the first drug approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for the treatment of patients with relapsed or refractory T-cell lymphoma. Following pralatrexate, romidepsin received approval from the U.S. FDA for the treatment of peripheral T-cell lymphoma, I think about a year or so later. What's interesting is that romidepsin belongs to a class of drugs we refer to as histone deacetylase inhibitors, or more broadly as epigenetic drugs. And what is really interesting is that these epigenetic drugs seem to have really interesting selective activity in T-cell lymphoma, and years before another drug we helped develop, vorinostat, actually attained approval from the FDA for the treatment of cutaneous T-cell lymphomas. As you heard Steve allude to, there are now drugs targeting discrete proteins on the surfaces of many of these cells, and Steve mentioned brentuximab vedotin, which is a drug that targets a protein called CD30. Which he mentioned was expressed on the surface of Reed-Sternberg cells, also happens to be expressed on nearly 100% of all cases of anaplastic large cell lymphoma, and is probably expressed on about 30% of all cases of other peripheral T-cell lymphomas. Brentuximab vedotin is a really interesting and new class of drug that we have to treat these diseases. It's an antibody-drug conjugate, meaning that it takes advantage of an antibody that targets the cell somewhat selectively and actually attaches to that antibody a small molecule that is brought into close proximity to the tumor cell and is able to destroy that tumor cell theoretically with less off-target effects on the normal cells. I think what's going to emerge and what's emerging now is that now that we have many of these new drugs that by themselves have really significant activity, and most of the studies, when you look at the trials that have treated patients with pralatrexate or romidepsin, many of the patients have been very, very heavily pretreated. Many of them have seen 3 or 4 or 5 lines of prior chemotherapy. And one of the things we know about drug development is if the sooner we can use the drug in the natural history of the disease, the better we think the outcomes will be. So what's happening next? The next generation of trials are actually going to look to take some of those standard backbones that we've been using to treat peripheral T-cell lymphoma, and one of the most common is called CHOP chemotherapy. It's a standard therapy used in many forms of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And many of these new drugs, like pralatrexate, like romidepsin, like brentuximab, are now being added to CHOP-based chemotherapy to see if we can't improve on the efficacy of that combination chemotherapy by now adding a drug that has its own unique activity in T-cell lymphoma. And these are going to be very large international trials. Many of them will require treating hundreds of patients on each of those trials. In addition to looking at combinations and of these T-cell active drugs with the conventional chemotherapy, there are other new platforms that are beginning to emerge. So there are studies that will begin to look at some of these new drugs in combination. So pralatrexate plus romidepsin in preclinical studies has demonstrated marked synergy of the two. So it makes complete sense that you have two drugs with independent activity, and the next question is how do they combine in terms of trying to synergize or additively increase the activity of those compounds in T-cell lymphoma. Clinical trials, I can't stress enough, are the most important venue we have at the moment in terms of trying to improve our management of these diseases. Every drug that we use to treat lymphoma is a drug that at some point in its history was studied in a clinical trial. And because many of the standards of care for these diseases leave us wanting to do a little bit better, the need to put patients on clinical trials is really incredibly important for the physicians as well as the patients. Many of these trials that we're looking at that are going to combine pralatrexate or romidepsin or brentuximab with CHOP chemotherapy represent a potential paradigm-shifting approach to the management of these diseases. Subsequent trials that will look at using these combinations for patients with relapsed or refractory disease, coupled with some other exciting new drugs like alisertib, are going to afford us an opportunity to survey the activity of these compounds, and if promising, a new opportunity to move them up front earlier in the natural history of these diseases. So while these are complex diseases that are relatively rare, I actually think this is probably the most exciting time in the history of these diseases to be involved in treating them, because we at long last have a variety of new tools and a variety of new drugs, and the challenge now on both the patient part and the professional treating physician part will be to try to get as many patients as we can on these clinical trials so we can more rapidly make progress towards improving the outcome of the management of these diseases. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. O'Connor, really for your expertise and also for your great enthusiasm in terms of just that this, there have been so many breakthroughs and so much happening in the field at this time. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much for this, for your presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Yun Kim, and Dr. Kim is the Joanne and Peter Haas Junior Professor for Cutaneous Lymphoma Research. She is also Director, Multidisciplinary Cutaneous Lymphoma Program, and Director, Photopheresis Service, Stanford University Medical Center. And Dr. Kim is going to provide an overview of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, emerging treatments for cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, and address the role of clinical trials. Dr. Kim?
Hi. Thank you so much for the opportunity to address yet another topic important in the skin. Dr. O'Connor has nicely given an overview of T-cell lymphomas as a group, and I think addressing skin has special issues that I'd like to highlight for those who are managing patients with skin lymphomas. The major difference is that skin is an organ that is covers our barrier function from the environment. It is extremely visible and tactile, so that has some visible and effects. And then also the skin has symptoms of pain or itching that's very unique to that compartment. And when we treat skin disease, we need to combine treatments that address directly the skin as well as other sites of involvement if that were to be the case. Now, those are the unique parts about the cutaneous T-cell lymphoma that would differentiate how you manage those patients than other systemic lymphomas. As a global overview, the incidence of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma is on the rise, and that may be due to a combination of diagnosing better or true incidence increase. There is 0.96 per 100,000 U.S. population, which brings about 3,000 new cases of cutaneous T-cell lymphomas a year. It's 4% of the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. It is a condition of the middle age, so the median age is 55, not pediatric, but all ages can be involved. In general, the patients who have present with worse skin involvement would tend to have more aggressive course, and that's why we treat those patients more aggressively. And then patients who have more than skin involvement obviously have more worse outcomes, so we would address those other than skin sites to make sure that the treatment is complete. And then there's other adverse factors such as hair follicle involvement, which we call follicular tropism, or large cell transformation, where the milder, small, medium-sized cells turn to larger, more the bad actor cells, and then that's an indication that we should treat the disease a little bit more intensively than previously. So as that as an overview, I'd like to just go through the standard care of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. Now, there are many types of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, as alluded to by Dr. O'Connor. The most common ones are the mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome, which is a majority. And probably the second most common is the CD30-positive lymphoproliferative disorders. And then there are the cytotoxic lymphomas and the more rare types. I will just address the overview of the more common mycosis fungoides and Sézary. Once we suspect a patient to have this entity group, we need to diagnose it properly. Given that it is a skin lymphoma, skin biopsy is critical. And I'd like to point attention to the fact that now we do have an NCCN guideline that's worldwide available by going on to the NCCN site. So we have a standard of care guideline that we can utilize to help our patients to get drugs and evaluations approved. So I highly encourage that folks utilize that as much as possible. So on the diagnosis, with the skin biopsy, we have other ancillary studies we have to do to come up with the proper diagnosis, but I think that is so important in skin because you have a confusion of skin and lymphomas and other rashes and other differentials. So proper diagnosis is not a minor point. And after a diagnosis, one will have to stage the patient. And we usually have this standard staging evaluation, which is the comprehensive exam and also the studies and imaging that is necessary, especially if you have patients with very extensive skin disease, they may be at higher risk to have more than skin involvement. So the staging would be appropriate. That would help you guide for the appropriate treatment. And also the blood compartment, as Dr. O'Connor mentioned, there are patients with leukemic involvement, which we name as Sézary syndrome, and those patients get managed quite differently. So it's important to look at the blood compartment with flow cytometry and appropriate markers that can detect that. Clonal gene rearrangements can be used to sort out benign inflammatory conditions with more neoplastic conditions like mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome, and that should be done when indicated. Once we have the staging done, then the management of the patient is stage dependent. So patients with mild disease, patches and plaques that are mild and limited, they have we should be treated with mild treatments. So it should not be treated with more aggressive treatment that will not do patients put them at any better advantageous state. So in milder patients with patch and plaque disease, we usually reach out for more of the skin treatments because that's where the disease is at, and the skin treatments are highly effective for limited disease patients, and these include topical steroids, topical nitrogen mustard, phototherapy, and those are the common skin treatments. Those patients who fail skin treatments or their disease do not respond to the skin treatment of different types, then we would reach for the milder systemic therapies for those patients, and those include categories such as retinoids, the bexarotene, xenophilans, the low-dose methotrexate, as well as HDAC inhibitors. For those patients who have more advanced disease, which is more of the tumor, skin tumor disease, erythrodermic patients, patients who have more than skin involvement from the beginning, Sézary patients, they're treated with usually a combination of skin plus a systemic agent. We definitely like to include the skin treatment partners since that is still highly effective for that skin compartment. For the Sézary patients, we do like to make sure that we address supportive care, which is topical steroids, the anti-itch regimens, since that is a significant component of quality of life. Patients may have be at high risk for skin infections, especially in Sézary. So being on antibiotic therapy may be very important. And we try to spare immune suppressive regimens in those patients with Sézary in the beginning as much as possible due to the risk of skin infections. Now, there are some exciting new treatments coming out in the CTCL category as well. This includes skin-directed treatments. Now that the natural mustard is at the FDA, getting FDA approval, we have new topical HDAC inhibitors that are under development, topical immune-enhancing agents in the category of similar to imiquimod, called riziquimod, and that could immune-enhance and get at the cancer cells topically. We have two phase three clinical trials that is up for evaluation and FDA consideration down the road, and the brentuximab vedotin that works really well in Hodgkin's and anaplastic large cell lymphoma is also quite effective in mycosis fungoides, and that is currently at a phase three clinical trial at multicenter, and also that trial includes patients with cutaneous anaplastic large cell lymphoma. There's also another drug, anti-CCR4, mogamulizumab antibody, which is highly effective, especially for Sézary patients. And this is an exciting treatment that is under phase three investigation at multicenter. And then we have other emerging developments where you would increase the immune function of the patient and to so that it helps your own immune cells to fight your cancer. And those immune checkpoint blockades are under current investigation. And then partnering these agents with other agents, as Dr. O'Connor mentioned, the combination regimens are significantly considered. Also, we're looking at how to use old drugs smarter or their old therapies in a better way, either by combining with other agents, by reducing toxicity and enhancing efficacy, and even the total skin electron beam that was used in the past, we use it in lower doses, which is equally effective but less toxic. And the ultimate therapy in CTCL, especially in the advanced diseases, includes a non-ablative allogeneic transplant, which multiple centers are investigating, and that is leading to a successful curative graft-versus lymphoma effect in many of the patients. And now our goal is to try to develop that to be effective, as well as utilize it in the safest way possible to learn to use it at the right time for our patients to do our patients the best benefit. And I'd like to stop there and refer to our host and questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kim, for a very comprehensive and excellent presentation. And I want to introduce now our next speaker is Mr. Brian Tomlinson. And Mr. Tomlinson is Chief Program Officer at the Lymphoma Research Foundation. He is indeed the architect of today's program, identifying our speakers and topics and securing the support for the program. And Mr. Tomlinson is going to address the free programs offered by the Lymphoma Research Foundation as a wonderful resource for all of you. Mr. Tomlinson?
Well, thank you, Carolyn, for that warm introduction. And again, thanks very much for the continued partnership on all of the LRF's lymphoma teleconferences for patients. We really enjoy working with cancer care. I'd also like to extend my thanks to our esteemed faculty, Drs. Ansel, Kim, and O'Connor, for taking time to be with us today and for all that they do for the Lymphoma Research Foundation throughout the year and for people dealing with the diagnosis of lymphoma. And lastly, I'd like to acknowledge the corporate supporters of today's call, Celgene, Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company, Seattle Genetics, and Spectrum Pharmaceuticals. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization, and we're devoted exclusively to funding innovative lymphoma research and providing people with lymphoma and healthcare professionals with up-to-date information about this type of cancer. Our mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. We invest millions of dollars each year to combat lymphoma and to assist those whose lives have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. The foundation remains dedicated to identifying a cure through an aggressively funded research program and to helping members of the lymphoma community by providing comprehensive disease-specific programs and services. To date, the organization has funded over $51 million in research, and more than 50,000 people access our programs and services each year. These programs and services include a lymphoma helpline where our professional, public, and mental health staff can assist you in your search for information, resources, and other support. You heard all of our speakers talk about the role and the importance of clinical trials. We have a clinical trials information service where if you call our helpline, a member of the staff can assist you in your search for clinical trials. We have a national lymphoma support network that is a one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients or caregivers with volunteers who have had similar lymphoma-related experiences. The foundation provides a host of print and web-based publications and newsletters, including comprehensive disease guides, disease-specific fact sheets, informational e-newsletters, and we have two resources that I'd like to point out, two disease-specific websites and electronic newsletters for people dealing with the diagnosis of anaplastic large cell lymphoma or Hodgkin lymphoma or peripheral T-cell lymphoma. You can visit these websites by visiting lymphoma.org or visiting the specific URLs, which are focusonalcl.org, focusonhl.org, or the PTCL site, which is focusonptcl.org. The foundation provides a variety of webcasts and podcasts available for specific types of lymphoma treatment options and support topics. And lastly, we sponsor a host of programs throughout the country that bring together lymphoma experts with patients in live meetings and conferences. For more information, please contact us by calling us at 1-800-500-9976 or visiting our main website, which is lymphoma.org. Back to you, Carolyn.
Thank you very much, Brian. Thanks. And if those of you who have not used the Lymphoma Research Foundation as a resource, please do. And those of you who are, continue to do so. It's just a great resource for everybody. Our next speaker is Mr. Richard Dickens. And Mr. Dickens is an oncology social worker. He's clinical supervisor and mind-body project coordinator at Cancer Care. And he's going to address the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care. Mr. Dickens.
Thank you, Carolyn. Building relationships with all members of your healthcare team is important, especially with a cancer like lymphoma. This usually includes a doctor, nurse, social worker, and other professionals. It's helpful to think of this as a partnership or collaboration. They are your primary treatment network and experts in your cancer and treatment, but you are the expert of your body and life, so it is important to let them know when you have a question. It is also important to build a personal support network of family and friends from your neighborhood and community center or house of worship. For many patients, it is hard to say, I need help. But for people who care about you, helping is one thing they can give. That is why with a chronic illness, building a support network is so important. And by reaching out to as many as possible, you help the caregivers to spread the help and thereby help themselves. Accepting changes are normal during treatment contributes toward nurturing your body and spirit, but stressors can elicit feelings of sadness and frustration. What is happening to the patient can make family and friends feel helpless and scared as well. This is when it is helpful to seek help of a social worker or other professionals from organizations such as Cancer Care. Cancer Care is oncology social workers who inform people of resources and strategies for finding help, which can include creating a blog to keep family and people informed for those who are computer savvy, or mind-body-spirit techniques to calm the mind and relax the body during stress. Along with education and resources, Cancer Care provides some financial assistance, counseling, regional face-to-face groups, and national telephone and online groups for patients and loved ones, all facilitated by oncology social workers. Groups provide role models, emotional support, coping strategies, and validation you're not alone. To many, social supports, getting to know your healthcare team, and support groups go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenges of cancer. And daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. You can call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, that's our HOPE line, and speak to a social worker to explore how we can help. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Rick. A wonderful presentation. Thank you. And now we have time for questions. And I'm going to ask Sam to explain to all of you how to queue up and ask questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, I'll give you 800 numbers to call at the end of the call. Both you can call the Lymphoma Research Foundation or Cancer Care for further help with your questions if we don't get to them. Let's see how many we can take now. So, Sam?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Our first question comes from Don Kay. Your line is now opened.
Yes, hi. Well, I wonder, is it possible to get a printout of today's program? Because there's a lot of drugs mentioned that I'm not sure I got down properly.
Well, that's an excellent question. There are materials that you can access from both organizations about these about Hodgkin and T-cell lymphomas. However, you also can all, for everyone, listen to this program either on telephone replay or as a podcast on our websites. So I hope that will help. And I'll be happy to talk to you afterwards. But just so everyone knows, this program, although it exists right now, it'll stay up for at least a year on our website and on telephone replay so that you'll be able to listen to it again. And there are materials and fact sheets that you'll be able to get from each organization that would spell out all of that information that you're asking for, that more detail. I hope that helps. Thank you. Our next question
comes from Linda D. Your line is now opened.
Thank you. I was wondering, can levothyroxine or shingles vaccine cause T-cell lymphomas?
Dr. Cano, could you address that?
There's no link between either of those things and T-cell lymphoma. There is a link that Dr. Ansel referred to with viruses, and there are some viruses, namely Epstein-Barr virus, that's associated with a very discrete kind of T-cell lymphoma, and another virus referred to as HTLV-1, which is a retrovirus that's associated with a disease called HTLV-1-ATLL. But other than those specific viruses, there's been no link with shingles, also a virally caused disease, but a different type of virus, of course, and no linkage, to my knowledge, with levothyroxine.
Thank you very much. Our next question.
Our next question comes from Wendy D. Your line is now opened.
Yes, I was wondering if mycosis fungoides can go to Sézary syndrome without any symptoms, if there's no plaque. Can it advance?
Okay. Thank you. And Dr. Kim, can you address that?
Sure. So mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome are different but yet related. So your very question is a very important one. There are patients with mycosis fungoides who has plaques or tumors or even erythroderma, the diffuse skin involvement, who do not present with leukemic or blood involvement that can evolve into having more of the significant blood involvement. Now, that transition or that progression is more rare in Sézary presentations, so that in most of the Sézary patients, they present in the beginning with diffuse disease in the skin and blood involvement. However, that change from MF to a leukemic phase can be seen. And if it does happen, then obviously we do need to address that blood involvement in our treatment strategy.
Thank you. And our next question?
Our next question comes from Judy J. Your line is now opened.
Are mycosis fungoides patients considered immunosuppressed?
Thank you for that question, Judy. Dr. Kim?
So in general, especially the early stages of mycosis fungoides, there is no clinically meaningful immune suppression whatsoever. So in patients with patch plaque, even limited tumor, and patients with even diffuse skin who have no blood or lymph node or other organ disease, their immune function that is practically for practical sense, is not impaired. So you're not at more risk for other infections. However, if you have more advanced disease where you have more than skin or the leukemic involvement like Sézary, then your immune function is somewhat impaired, one from the disease, but more from all the treatments that you may be receiving that also knock your immune system down. So there is an effect from the treatment as well when you have more advanced disease. But early stages, definitely not.
And we have a question from one of our online participants, and that's a very general question, and the question is, what is the lymphatic system? Dr. O'Connor, would you like to address that?
It one more time.
What is the lymphatic system?
What is the lymphatic system? So the lymphatic system is a network of small vessels that connects various lymph nodes throughout the body. It often runs in parallel with the veins of the body, and the lymphatic system plays a critical role in your immune system, and it is also the site where many of the lymphocytes that are born in your bone marrow that exit the bone marrow, they circulate in your blood, and they actually land in various lymph nodes around the body. And these lymph nodes are major centers of higher education if you're a lymphocyte. It's where lymphocytes learn how to become card-carrying members of your immune system, and they learn how to recognize discrete kinds of antigens or infections such that when you get exposed, your body's immune system is able to mount a response. So the lymphatic system is just this broader network of interactions between lymph nodes, your spleen, and other lymphoid tissues in the body that all play a central role in educating and trafficking lymphocytes so that they can be a functional part of your immune system.
Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants. Where is T-cell receptor gene rearrangement testing performed? Dr. O'Connor again?
So the T-cell receptor gene rearrangements are like analogous to immunoglobulin gene rearrangements that we look at in B-cell lymphomas. And these rearrangements are indicative of cells that have become clonal, those that are now have transformed and would meet those definitions of a malignant cell that Dr. Ansel described earlier. Those tests for that are typically performed either at hospitals that have the capability, and for those hospitals that don't, they're oftentimes sent out to other laboratories that have those capabilities. It's important to note that T-cell receptor gene rearrangements, while a feature of a transformed or malignant cell, are not always transformed in every single case of T-cell lymphoma. So there can be a sizable number of peripheral T-cell lymphomas that have not that don't have a demonstrable evidence of that T-cell receptor gene rearrangement, but still are T-cell lymphomas. And this really highlights another really important point that I failed to mention earlier, which is just as critical as it is to get a good clinician's perspective on your disease and how best to management, confirmation of the pathology is really critical, because everything we as lymphoma specialists recommend is ultimately very linked to what the pathologists tell us is the type of disease you have. So making sure that you have a good hematopathology review by specialized centers is actually really important in the process and something that's easily overlooked.
This is Yan Chen.
Yes.
I would like to just add a comment relevant to the skin T-cell lymphomas, because the interpretation of the clonality, I think, is so important, especially in the skin, because so many inflammatory benign diseases can also be clonal. So I just want to make sure that the audience, the listeners, are aware that clonality does not equate malignancy, especially in the skin conditions. There's many other inflammatory ones that are clonal.
Excellent. And can you comment on just the how the pathologists, who might one want to seek in terms of the pathologist that would be the best to actually utilize?
So oftentimes it's not so easy to identify a pathologist to go see. You can't really make an appointment to see a pathologist. What is a better thing to do is sort of look at teams that have expertise in the disease. And Dr. Kim has built a nationally recognized team focused on cutaneous T-cell lymphomas out in Stanford. And in doing that, she's assembled clinicians and dermatologists and hematopathologists, all intently focused on those diseases. And the same is true at the Mayo Clinic with Dr. Ansel. So when you're looking for particular features of the diagnosis and you're looking in detail, looking for hematopathologists is not the way to do it. What you really want to do is find those clinicians who are very familiar with the disease and expert at managing it, and those clinicians, as a part of their team-building efforts at that institution, will bring in the best hematopathologists with whom they work that will help you tell the whole story from treatment to diagnosis to prognosis.
And I just want to second what Dr. O'Connor just said, that it's so important that, especially I think in skin, where there is a lot of confusion with other rashes, that it's a clinical pathologic diagnosis where it's a puzzle. You have to combine the skin, the pathology, and other ancillary tests like the clonality and come up with the final appropriate diagnosis. And I'm sure in the systemic T-cell lymphomas, even in the lymph nodes, that's, you know, always has to be considered as well in terms of inflammatory or other reactive things. So I just wanted to stress that a team effort in with those who are aware of other things that can occur that can mimic lymphomas is very important to be aware.
Thank you. And Dr. Ansel, did you want to comment as well?
No, I think the points have been well made. I do feel that the team approach is critical, and I think, as all of the speakers have highlighted, that really allows you to get optimal care.
And with another question from one of our online participants, and that is that my 25-year-old son has been diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, stage 2A, and her oncologist is planning a workup and just wanted to kind of get a sense of some of the common tests that are done in evaluating stage 2A Hodgkin's disease. Dr. Ansel, could you address this in a general way, of course, and then
right.
we'll ask our caller to go back to their healthcare team with this information.
As I mentioned in my presentation, knowing exactly the extent of the disease in one's body is critical to really being able to define a good treatment plan. So common tests that are done for what appear to be clinical stage 2A Hodgkin lymphoma include a staging evaluation using CAT scans and PET scans. Sometimes a combined CT PET, which does it all at once, is a very common and important test. Additionally, in some patients, if there's any more extensive disease, a bone marrow test will also be done to exclude the possibility of cells present in the bone marrow. Additionally, blood work is done to really understand if there are any features that suggest that the disease is going to be more badly behaved or well behaved, and those can include the number of lymphocytes, the hemoglobin, the albumin, and other tests in the blood. And additional tests that are often done are just to make sure that the heart function and lung function of the patient are adequate as one considers giving treatment that can affect that. And that can include a heart test for the ejection fraction or the strength of the heart with a pumping action by way of a mugger scan or an echocardiogram, and sometimes pulmonary function testing to see how well your lung function is also done. So those are the common standard therapies. And then I guess I would add one other thing, and that is in young patients before getting chemotherapy, consideration for preservation of fertility is also important, and so often that is addressed as well.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Very, very comprehensive, and thank you for that answer. We have another question from an online participant. I have hepatosplenic T-cell lymphoma and frequently experience night sweats and malaise. Is there a way to reduce these symptoms? Dr. O'Connor, could you address that?
So hepatosplenic T-cell lymphoma is a comparatively rare disease, even amongst all the T-cell lymphomas. And it's known to come in itself a variety of different flavors, the biology of which also can revolve around the kind of T-cell receptor gene rearrangements you have, which we talked about a little bit earlier. When we talked about T-cell gene rearrangements, classically most T-cell lymphomas have what's referred to as the alpha-beta gene rearrangements. Some variations of the hepatosplenic or splenic T-cell lymphomas can have other kinds called the gamma-delta. The symptoms that you're describing in terms of night sweats and other constitutional complaints are relatively common with many, many kinds of lymphoma. And before I, there's no one generic answer on how to make that go away, but typically you have to think about one of two things. One is the disease itself is associated with these constitutional complaints because, as you heard earlier, these lymphomas are derived from cells that are professional infection-fighting cells. And when you get infections, oftentimes patients can experience fever or sweating or other chills and other constitutional complaints that are reminiscent of infection. So it's not too surprising that patients with lymphoma actually experience many of the same constitutional complaints as someone who has infection. And so it's not reasonable for me to give you one broad dramatic perspective on how to manage this other than to say it's probably appropriate for you to talk to your doctor, because deciphering whether these are due to infection or progression of the disease is really critical, because you treat them differently, and obviously treating an infection promptly is really important.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have one other question from one of our online participants. I have cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. What are the long-lasting effects of electron beam therapy? Dr. Kim, could you address that?
So electron beam therapy, I'm assuming that the question is the total skin. Would you clarify that for me versus local
radiation? That's an excellent question. I don't the person has just put that question in there as an online question, so it
I will address both. So the, and you said the side effects, correct?
yes, the long-term side effects.
Right. So the total skin electron beam is a way to give skin electrons to the skin depth through the entire skin. And I think this is why I mentioned earlier that we are using lower doses at this time. And I think in radiation field in general, there's a paradigm shift that's trying to use lower doses to minimize toxicity, acute or long-term. So if you use total skin at the standard dose, which is at 36 gray, which is, takes about 9 weeks, and has skin toxicity short-term, as well as especially those who have been treated with phototherapy and other skin-damaging treatments previous to that, then there's additive, cumulative side effects to skin, and they're especially at risk for developing squamous cell carcinoma more than any other skin cancer type, but including melanoma if there's family risk in the skin. So that would be the long-term complication, especially if you had cumulative skin-damaging treatments in addition to total skin. So our approach is to use lower doses. So now us and UK and other centers are using one-third the total dose skin, which gives actually the same efficacy, and neither of them cure it for long-term. Our goal is to control the symptoms, and then you can use that lower dose even repetitively along the course of time, especially if you want to avoid systemic treatment side effects. So that is kind of the situation with total skin. Now, local treatment let's say you have a localized tumor that's refractory to other treatments, we would use local electrons. And the standard guideline is about the maximum dose you should give in a lifetime to a same site would be about 60 gray. So, and you can treat local sites repetitively too. However, once you go above about 60 gray, then you're going to ask for some side effects to that site, including sclerosis and ulcerations.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank all of our faculty today. They've just been really outstanding, just really all of you, and all of you who also have either queued up and asked questions on the phone or who've asked your questions online, that really helped to really expand the call. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program and that we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program and indeed may have many other questions that you wish to ask or services that you wish to access or programs from us. So I'm going to again repeat the phone number for the Lymphoma Research Foundation, which is 1-800-500-9976. And for Cancer Care, 1-800-813-4673. Most importantly, as we conclude today, we don't want any one of you to feel that you're alone in coping with lymphoma or cancer. We want you to know that you're part of a community of support. Please call us. We're here for you. And I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for participating.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.